This is DJ Kick, and you're listening to Steve Kelly Delivers, where you get a glass and a half of inspiring, influential, and interesting guests with every podcast. You can follow Steve Kelly Delivers on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Steve Kelly Delivers is listener-supported on Venmo.com.
Hello, and welcome to Episode 3 of Steve Kelly Delivers. It is a podcast that brings you quality entertainment first class. If you go to my website, stevekellydelivers.com, from there you can access my Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram accounts. Steve Kelly Delivers is a podcast supported by listeners just like you. And if you make a donation to my show via Venmo, I will give you an acknowledgement on the intro portion of my next podcast. Now, let me deliver my awesome conversation to you as I introduce my wonderful guest from the hit TV show The Walking Dead. I introduce to you Blaine Rincon. Blaine, thank you so much for showing up on Steve Kelly Delivers. I'm thrilled to have you as a guest. A savior from The Walking Dead is a guest on my third podcast. Blaine, and also, Blaine, I wanted to thank you for your service to this country because I understand you're an Air Force veteran. Thank you very much.
I did that.
And you know what? That would probably be a good place to start off this conversation with, is your career in the Air Force.
All right. Well, right out of high school, I didn't go in the military right then. I went for a year of college, which I don't know if you'd actually call it going to college. I just kind of attended. You know, not one of those stellar performances in college that you would like. So after about a year, I was like, you know, I was thinking that, you know, maybe that'd be something I like to do. Maybe I could go in. I like, you know, there's one thing is that I'm a car person. Love cars. Like messing around a little on the mechanic side. Working on jets would be pretty interesting, I thought. So I decided I would go with the Air Force, and I did. And I did. I liked it to a degree. You know, when you're young, it's really hard to nail down exactly what you're going to be doing. Sometimes when you're my age, you're still trying to nail down exactly what you're trying to do. So.
Oh, yeah.
But I went in about, I think it was January 85. I went into the military, basic training. Everybody in the Air Force goes to Lackland Air Force Base, of course. And my career that I decided on was, at that time, was aircraft maintenance. So I was a tactical aircraft maintenance specialist, as we refer to it. I worked on F-15s, A, B, and C models. Mostly, which was kind of cool. I mean, the experience and the basic training was better, actually, than what I thought it would be. Now, basically, you do have a lot of the stress that you have to deal with.
Oh, of course.
You know, it's more of a, you know, learn how to adjust to it, how the game's played, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
And just go with it, you know. So, the camaraderie that you pick up in the basic training is actually better than what I didn't expect that. Now, there was a lot of that. We all stuck together. We all hung together. We, run into a couple of people every now and then that I knew from back then. It's really cool. Tech schools in Fort Worth area and Shepherd Air Force Base, in fact. But we had a, being around the planes that you see when you're growing up as a kid, you see these pictures and images of these jets, and all of a sudden, here I am working on them, so it was really quite an experience to be able to do that. Also, that's about the time, you realize that you're basically an adult for legally. Now, mentally, I'm pretty sure my wife would agree I'm probably not there yet. No laughing, please. She's over here laughing at me now. But you do get that sense that you're in the world now, and you've got a lot of responsibilities. I'm working on aircraft. If I do something wrong, it could cause irreparable damage to places or things.
Oh, that is definitely a big responsibility.
Yeah, it's sort of scary in a way, but at the same time, you get a lot of pride from that. But I I was at Eglin Air Force Base stationed at the 33rd Fighter Wing at that time, and there was a lot of experiences. You know, where I got to see, where I got to go, what I did. Eglin has what they call a climatic hangar, where they test a lot of the aircraft for different temperatures. So I see numerous aircraft fly in all the time that I'm not normally seeing, you know, fly in. So I got to see that. Working on aircraft is really, it was quite an experience. But at that time, I really didn't know if that was what I really wanted to do the rest of my life, especially one time in particular when it was like, I was at Eglin Air Force Base, but it was 40 degrees, it was raining, and I was on the tail wing of the F-15, and I was wondering if I really wanted to do that for a long time, an extended period of time. And I could be in Alaska, is what I was thinking. So, you know, I was really wasn't sure exactly what I'm doing, but I did take advantage of the educational part, tried to learn as much as I could, got a lot of training in there. I didn't pursue aircraft maintenance once I got out, but got a lot of inside knowledge on how things work. And one of the drawbacks of being somebody that loves working on mechanical stuff, you know, whenever you're a teenager, you're tooling around on a car, you change the timing a little bit, you go in there and tweaked on the carburetor a little bit, maybe add a little bit of, you know, new plugs, new wires, maybe put some headers on it. First thing you do, you're going to jump in and drive it. They never let me once test drive those jets when I was in the Air Force.
Oh, see, that just ain't right.
That was one of those things you think about later. So, you know, I never get to drive these things. That's taking the fun out of
it. Oh, definitely. But, you know, it's like not quite like the cars you tinker with. I mean, those things do like 0 to Mach 3 in like 1.2 seconds. That's big difference between 0 and 60.
And the F-15 was one of the only aircraft in the world that would actually accelerate going straight up. Most aircraft die after a little while. Start pulling there. The F-15 would still climb.
Yeah. Oh, the F-15 fighters absolutely are probably the best jets that they came out with.
Yeah, I still have a fascination for it. Every now and then I'll find an old picture of a tail wing that has EZ on it. I'll try to look at the tail number to see if that was one I'd worked on, because I've worked on so many of them. We had the whole fleet out there. We had, you know, 3 different divisions at that time. And being that I worked in a specialized area, because I worked on flight control, landing gear, and canopy repair, cable adjustments, throttle cables. So we didn't work in one specific squadron. I worked on 3 squadrons and just wherever, which one I needed. So every now and then I'll find an old picture of one that, you know, I can like say, hey, you know, I was on that one. I stood on that one. I sat in the cockpit of that one or something like that, which is really kind of neat. You know?
Great. So outside of the U.S., because I know the Air Force, you tend to see a lot of Texas, a lot of Lackland Air Force Base. You don't really get to see too much overseas, or did you?
Well, I was one of the good things about a fighter wing, especially with at that time the 33rd was, you know, really ranked as one of the top ones of the day. We had TDYs that would go up against other aircraft squadrons and fly against them, do their little training and all. So I did get, as a TDY, I did get to volunteer, and we were strictly a volunteer basis whenever I was in. I got to see Homestead Air Force Base at that time before, I think, Andrew, you know, blew it away. Hurricane Andrew came through and tore it all up, and after that, I think it turned into a race park. But over at Homestead Air Force Base, I got to see Tucson, Arizona, which was, you know, for a boy like me that grew up in South Georgia, you know, seeing something like Tucson is totally different.
And, oh, it is.
Yeah. Places I got to visit was Arizona, Florida, Virginia, Maine, Labrador, which there's not really anything to visit there, but Germany, and stop over in England one time.
Oh, all right.
In Germany, we were at a 30-day TDY over there. We did that. Every 2 years, we would go to Germany to this one place. It was a Canadian air base called LAR. Fantastic place. The base was great. The area was phenomenal. We're in the Black Forest region of Germany, South Germany. A friend of mine at that time was his parents still lived in Germany. I think what it was that he was born in the U.S. and he claimed dual citizenship, and he joined the U.S. Air Force when he was 18, but he was fluent in German and fluent in Spanish. A little bit of story behind him, but we'll get into that on air. But I was single at that time. Now, he was married, and he was TDY with us. Well, he, while I was there, he was going to go see his parents. And it was a Saturday morning in October. We were over there in September and October in Germany, which was a really good time to be there.
Oktoberfest, absolutely.
I was Saturday morning, I heard a knock on my door, and I was half asleep. He goes, "Hey, I got my parents' BMW. You want to go to Switzerland?" I'm like, I was packed and gone in 5 minutes. So, yeah, we went down Lake Constance, I believe is the name of it. There's another name for it. I can't remember what it is. But we drove down through, it was basically like a circle. You come down through Switzerland. We drove over towards Switzerland, towards the end of Switzerland to Austria. But right about there, you hit this little tiny country called Liechtenstein. I even got to visit there for a day. Then we drove over to Innsbruck, Austria. And then we swung back through Bavaria and seen quite a few things over there. There was one that was even in Linderhof, Germany, in Bavaria. One of the King Ludwig's hunting lodge is what they referred to it as. It's one of his small palaces. It was very nice. Got to see that. It was really unique to see all this stuff. And he even took me, he said, "I'm going to show you." He said, "I know you were," and that time everybody knew I was still into art then, because I've been in art all my life. And he said, "I know you like to do a lot of art stuff, but I'm going to show you this one thing." We pulled up in this country church, and it was like 9 o'clock at night, very dark. And he said, "We're going to go in there, and I'm going to go wake up the priest, and I'm going to take you." He said, no, don't wake up the priest. What's up? He said, "No, it's cool. It's all right." So, and I was like, "All right." Well, me and these other two guys that was in the car with us, we were waiting, and he went, and he come motioned us up. The priest come up and opened the door for us, and he let us in. He said we can take about an hour or so if we want to just take our time looking through here. So what are we looking at? We walked into this little country-looking church in the middle of Germany, which I have no idea where it's at. I'll never figure out where it's at again in my life. And it had, like, these painted frescoes all the way down the wall. And there was a second tier that had, like, gold and wrought iron gilded fence kind of stuff up there. You could walk on the second level and look at all these frescoes. And some were painted 400 and 500 years ago. And I was just blown away by seeing all this culture. You don't see culture like that around here. I mean, 200 years, 300 years max. But we're talking like, in Germany, you're finding places that's 600 years old. And
oh, definitely.
And it's amazing to see that kind of cultural history in one spot, especially for some, little redneck kid like me that grew up in South Georgia. And all of a sudden, you're thrust into a place that has thousands of years of history here.
Oh, and architecture, absolutely.
Really cool, So, but yeah, I spent one tour in that, and I got out. It was, for the most part, peacetime operation whenever I was in. I got out in 88. I would have been in for a year or two longer, but they had this budget bill come out, and they said, "Hey, we're going to need to go ahead and re-enlist now or get out now." I'm like, I was thinking I had about a year to go with that, but so I went ahead and got out early and went back to college. So that was the extent of my military career. It was a little over 3 years.
Oh, all right. Nice. But still, you got to see a lot. You got to do a lot.
Yeah.
And I know that...
The time for anything, just for everything that I got to do, got to see, where I got to go, what I got to work on. It's just knowing whenever I stood up there at the medical examiner processing station and raised my hand and gave that oath, this overwhelming sense of pride kind of comes over you, so you're like, I'm really doing this. Oh, geez, first you're not sure if you just took a grand step or you just, took the first step into hell. You're not really sure which one's which at that time until later, but it was great. So.
Oh, awesome. And also you touched on, a couple of talking points. You went back to college, but then you were saying that even when you were, you very young age, you went into the military, you were kind of always an artist. Let's find out, where did you go to college for? Would probably be a good first question, and then from there.
Well, I can even go back to tell you exactly where the first time I really wanted to draw something, I mean, you know, when I was a kid playing in the sand and stuff, but I got an older brother, he's 8 years older than me, and I was looking at something, and he picked up his notebook, and I opened it up, and he'd drawn a picture of a spider crawling over this hill, like a giant spider attacking a town, and I looked at it, he said, "Hey, you like what I drew?" And all I could think was, like, I know I could draw something better than that. And I was in first grade, you know. I was trying to sketch that. So I remember my first taste of the art was trying to do something better than my brother was basically having
that. Sibling rivalry.
So, and it was like that the rest of my life. I was always drawing something, sketching something, trying to build something that, you know, not so much as neat and clean build, but just throwing stuff together and going, man, that's weird, you know, that kind of thing. So, but my first endeavor into college was at, in Dothan, Alabama. Wallace Community College is where I was going. It was a disaster. You know, I went there and I was to art history, and then I had to realize I got to take writing. I didn't even pay attention in English class when I was in high school. I mean, much less learn anything. I don't know how he got out of that safe shade. I don't even remember my senior year in high school, but that's a different story.
that's another podcast.
But it and also, you know, we're talking 83. That's a long time ago. Yeah, I'm 53 this year, just in case. I'm going to go ahead and clear that up. Yeah, I know it's a shocker. Yeah.
There you go. It's out there. Listeners.
But 83, the biggest thing you could do for writing, I'm like, I got to type. I couldn't type to save my life. I mean, we're talking chicken. And then we're talking typewriters, no word processor, no computer, no nothing like that. We're talking typing. If you wanted, you can always pay somebody to type it for you. But then, you know, Shelly,
I
had to pay for everything. I was like, I don't know if this is really for me or not. Plus, I had that phenomenal GPA of 1.45. it was, like I said, it was a disaster when I was in my first year in college. And all I could think of was I wanted to do something different. And we were right next to a small airport, and every day a jet would take off, and I was just sitting there looking at it, and I was thinking, I want to be on that going somewhere. I don't know where, just want to go somewhere. And that spurred a lot of my interest in the Air Force as well, because it's just a good opportunity to go someplace. So, but the one thing in the basic training that I did learn that really hit me hard, in fact, was first thing they did, so you're going to be taking some human relation classes. I was like, I just left college, now I got to go back into class. So I'm sitting there in class, same thing, desk, students, instructor. Except this time the instructor wore a drill sergeant hat, and he's sitting, you know, you're writing, you got somebody yelling in your ear, and you can't stop and look back at him. You got to stay with it, you know. And all I could think of was how easy I had it when I was in college. And that was the dawn of where, when I went back to school, that was what turned everything around for me when I went back to school, because I never went below a GPA of 3.7 when I went back to school. But
nice.
It was just, I had to have something to kind of hit me in the face, you know, some realization to kind of wake you up a little bit and say, you need to snap out of it. You need to quit being a kid, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, so that kind of woke you up. And
being a kid. But, you know, I could go to school now any classroom and sit down, and I think I could, you know, I could learn, I could listen, I can take in what's given to me.
All right, great. And now you touched on the fact that you weren't very good at writing with typing, but
right,
you're like dabbling in short stories with that deal with science fiction and horror stuff that I'm like really into. So I and my listeners both would love to hear, if you wanted to talk about some of what you're working on writing.
You know, writing and, to me, writing, acting, and art, fine arts, painting, all go together so well. I mean, you have some of the same creative aspects of it. You gotta, you know, it's not like, I don't plan a lot of my art. I don't plan my stories out. And what acting I do, I haven't gotten to the point where I've thought about it for months and weeks on end, because I haven't got that far into it yet. I've still done a few short films and all. But as far as creating, I think the more I got into fine arts, such as painting and drawing, the more writing gained my interest as I started scribbling. And there was a couple of times I really get into this creative mode in college where you're surrounded by everybody's doing some creative, everybody's working on some drawing, and you're feeding off of each other, and it just it's almost like you can't hold it in sometimes. So I start writing a little bit, wrote a few stories. I had a few incidents when I was a child that, you know, that was tough to deal with, like a death or a loss. And one every year was kind of hitting me hard, and I sat down and wrote it out in a story, and it was tough to write it. But once I got done with it, it was like I lived it out on paper, and I got a lot of it out, and I found that was a good way to do that. So I started writing a little bit more, some of what I was feeling, maybe going through a depressive time, I can write down what I'm thinking, you know, get that out. Don't like to write down a lot in case something, you know, I had to be careful what I wrote down. I mean, if something was happening and I didn't make it one day, you know, I don't want somebody to pick up my journal, I'm like, man, what a freak. But so I had to kind of tone it down a little bit. Yeah, but, you know, as far as what I was feeling, it does help to get that out. It's, to me, it's another creative aspect of the fine art world. And, you know, you get back to the fine arts and creative writing just as you can sculpture or theater or painting, you know.
Oh, absolutely. And, like, I know for me, like, when it comes to trying to express myself artistically, like, one thing that I would do, I like to sing karaoke from time to time.
And
yes, I love it. And, like, sometimes I'll pick a song that, even if I can't ace it, if I feel it's a difficult song, I'll pick something like, okay, this is the mood I'm in. I kind of need to express this. And I, like, put emotion into it, and it just, like, how you did with your writing, and it really does just let you get out some of the things that are going on inside of you, and it...
Yeah, it does. A lot of songs can really hit home for what you're feeling, too. You know, somebody's always got something going on inside that you can relate to, that somebody has put a pen to paper and let that out.
And oh, and put words to it in music.
Some of these songs are like that. Say one that I'm still, you know, a lot of people, you know, that you'll meet as they get older, their music tastes change. I think mine have gotten a little bit, they're pretty much the same. Because my current playlist is like, you know, Stained and Breaking Benjamin, that kind of thing. Stained, Aaron Lewis, the guy that, the main guy for Stained, some of his writing, you can tell he's been through a lot. He can put it down on paper a lot of how I feel sometimes and what I'm thinking. I was like, I know what he's thinking right there. Breaking Benjamin, when you're listening to those songs, you can hear he's going through some stuff, and songs, you know, music like that, you can really, something's going to hit you. You're going to, I know where they've been. I know what they're thinking. I can feel for it. I think we can relate, you know, even though I've probably never meet them. But, you know.
Oh, definitely.
It just has that kind of effect on people.
Oh, it absolutely does. And another thing I noticed on your Twitter account, you have a weird sense of humor. And, you know, like, people that are autistic, like, I think that I have, like, kind of, like, a same weird sense of humor, too. It probably has a lot to do with that, but...
Yeah, I think so.
Like what kind of things would you, like, either pranks you would play, or, like, how would you express this weird sense of humor?
I'm not so much of as much as I am into pranks, because, you know, okay, I'm not a small guy. I'm about 6 feet, about 245. But when I was growing up, I was not what you would say a big kid. I was kind of scrawny, actually. Got picked on a lot, you know. And so I've always had this aversion to pranks. Small ones, once in a while, you know, with my daughters, you know, she comes walking in, I'm like hiding behind the door, or I don't hide, I just sit there, and she goes, well, where's dad, you know, and I just go, boo, and it freaks her out, and I can't help that, that's just the way you are with kids. I think she's keeping a count. I think she has 6 times that she has to get me back, because she keeps jumping out and trying to scare me, and I'm like, oh, it's you, you know, and she's like, ah, I'm going to get you back one day. So she says she still owes me for 6 good scares, so, it'll go up, you know. So my idea of humor is like whenever she has friends over and I walk up to the door, instead of just knocking on the door and say, excuse me, I need to ask you something. I just walk up the door and I'm like scratching on the door. Like, what's that? You can hear, what's that noise? And I'm like, and then when they open the door, it's like, and I'm going, ah. And so that's one of the ones where they screamed and jumped the other side of the room because they were watching a scary movie. And then I got hit by them. So that's the kind of, you know, warped humor I got. I'm always, everything's humorous to me. I prefer to take things with a grain of salt. I do not take myself very seriously at all. If I do, it's only because I'm trying to go with a certain part for the most time. For the most part, that's what I am. I'm probably the one that has, I guess, like on my day job when I'm hanging out there, you can tell when somebody says something that they know that I'm going to automatically take it and twist it into something weird, because they'll stop and they'll just turn and they'll look at me and I'm like, remember that one. Because I'm the one that does that. So, and I humor's the thing. I got that from my mom. My mom's someone who loved humor. She loved jokes, even when they were inappropriate. And it was just, it's just the way my mom was. I got it from her. Yeah.
On my side, I got like my sense of humor from my dad. You know, even though his jokes are corny, looking back on it, you know, I'm like, that's probably where, I'm sure that's where I got my sense of humor from.
You know, I embrace the dad jokes right now. Nowadays, I do that because, you know, so that was awful. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, I've got another one, you know, so I do that a lot. Yeah. And my girls know it. And that's one of the things when I guess some of my first forays into acting was actually dealing with them, because I could say something and they would look at me like, you're lying, aren't you? I'm like, no. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Really? I was like, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding. You know, that's, you know, it was little things like that. I was like, you know, I've always wanted to be an actor, except that I was also, when I was younger, I was the shyest person probably in my town. I couldn't, it was awful. I mean, very, very bad. So that's where I got a lot of the humor, kind of, whenever I was not associating with people, you know, you read joke books, you read humor books, and that's what I did. I loved reading humor. So I got a lot of it from that, too.
Yeah, and that, like, that sense of humor that you were saying, that, like, you'll string someone along, like, oh, no, I'm serious. Then you turn around, no, I'm kidding. That reminds me of somebody that...
My kids, because now they're just so mad, because they can never tell whether I'm actually serious or not, and I have to actually tell them, okay, I'm really serious, and they're like, yeah, sure you are. No, I'm serious. it kind of backfires sometimes, but usually it's just a lot of fun.
Oh, but I mean, that reminds me of someone at work that I work with. He does the same thing, like, all the time. He'll constantly say something outlandish, and then he'll kind of stick with it. Yeah. And then he's like, no, I'm kidding. And then it's like, okay, I know you, where's the no, I'm kidding part coming up? I know it's coming. All right. So primarily you work as a graphic designer. Is that your, like, main
nine to five kind of
job?
Kind of goes in with the art thing. I spent a number of years in Panama City Beach as an airbrush artist, working on t-shirts, doing stuff for the tourist industry. I had one of the places I worked at had a large sign that they had paid a lot of money for. And, well, something happened to his business, and he said, we're going to be shutting down in October. You know, it's going to be tough, but I'm going to introduce you to a guy that he might have some side work for you as an airbrush artist, because this was in, oh, God, that's 91. And all and at this sign company, all they had was just a little pen and ink, you know, plotter to draw out a sign, and I would take them, and he'd give me the colors, and I would airbrush and try to give it the colors that he wanted, so he'd use them in sales presentation. But eventually, they got to where they, you know, color printers started coming in more into shape by then. So I did that a few times. But as an airbrush artist, I had a lot of hand-eye coordination. I had moved. I wanted my first daughter to grow up around my family, so to speak. At least I thought I did. So we moved up there to Alabama, where my family is all situated in. This is when I was living in Panama City, Florida. So we moved up there, and while I was there, my brother's wife said her brother was working a sign company and wanted to know if I would be interested in doing like some hand cut vinyl, because being that I had a hand eye coordination okay, that I might work into that. So I said, yeah, sure. So I went and talked to him and I started working that. So I started working, cutting it, doing hand cut vinyl in 95. These large signs for like you see at Home Depot, 12 by 12s and stuff like that, where I'm doing a lot of hand cut. And then we put this vinyl on, so they put it up and they stretch down to this face. Then I went from there. I was like, well, at that time, I'd never even touched a computer. So there was a classes were being taught downtown. And I went downtown one time and started taking a class just to get familiar with how a computer works. And it went from there to learning the program that they had. And hey, dog, I got a dog here too. So, no, she's fine. She's hanging out. But that went from working on that vinyl to printing it up to learning the computer to where I worked in a department that was strictly drawing up patterns for certain installations. And this is within the course of a year. And then I moved to Panama City to go back to school because I had started school down there after I was in the military, but I had dropped out for a while. And I went back down there and I started up at another place, and then went from there working on doing basic design, and then went into a little bit more design. And this is by 97, I was doing a little bit more of a marketing type design. So I'm doing like the presentations that they use in the sales pitches and all. I left there and drove a truck for Coca-Cola. I still have my commercial license, by the way. So.
Oh, cool.
I've kept that. And I figured it's something you never know when you might need it. I got a Class A license to drive a semi, you know. But the I drove a truck for a while, but I made good money. But you know, I mean, that's more of a younger man's game. And this is when I was 33. It was a younger man's game because it was killing me. Yeah, I'm like, yeah, it's unloading all these things. It was, and then I got a call from that place I was working at. I said, hey, we got an opening up in the main design department. Would you be interested? I was like, yeah, I'll be there in like just a couple of weeks. So I went back there, and I've been off and on between signs and doing some airbrush since then. For the most part, that's pretty much all I've done, and which brought me to Atlanta, in fact. And I came up here to work at a particular sign company with my wife. My wife came up here to work at one place. I just came up here and I started working somewhere else, and it seemed to have worked out pretty good with that, you know. And that's where I ran into my first time. She had mentioned to me, said, hey, there's look for extras for one of the Captain America movies. I'm like, I don't know if I can do that, because there's a lot of people, you know, going after that, you know. And I'm still just, by the time I hit 40, I was just starting to remove a lot of that shyness that I'd grown up with. Had a lot to do with doing airbrush, because I'm dealing with customers all the time and talking more and more across the counter. So, and when I got up here, finally one time I sent in, I was like, I think that might be something I'd like to try. So the first time I got on, I got a call to be an extra in the Liam Neeson movie, the one that came out this past year called Mark Fell, you know, the man who brought down Washington.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was in that, but I am so far in the back of this barroom scene, you can't even tell it's me. Yeah, I know I'm there. No one else would know I'm there. But then I worked on the one for National Geographic. They made the movie called Killing Reagan. And actually, it's an excellent movie. And, you know, if you ever get a chance to see that, you should check it out. And I was one of the, whenever he made his return back to the Congress, when they said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, Vice President of the United States, everybody standing up cheering and all this, I was in that crowd, except I was at the very back. And then what happened was that they trimmed the scene down to about like this and cut me out of that. So I didn't even get in that one either. So my first actual on-screen appearance was The Walking Dead. So that's like walking out to a major league and getting the first pitch and putting it out over the fence. To me, that's the way it felt like. I was like, wow, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Being a major fan of the show, to where me and this one of my friends, J.D. Hahn, who was also a savior, we're looking at each other and we're like, we're on set of Walking Dead. He goes, I know, it's awesome. And like, yeah, this is cool, you know. So it just kind of went and escalated into that. So, but that's how it kind of went from one to the other.
All right. And before we get into The Walking Dead, because you know that there is a lot to talk about there. You're going to school still at the Robert Mello Studio Acting School?
I'm taking a break right now until at least about June, I think. Trying to get a few things straightened out with, as far as working, taking care of everybody, making sure all the girls are on. The school is getting close to the end of the... I got one that's going to be graduating this year. So I'm going to wait and then pick it back up again. I did up until right at the end of the year, this past year. In fact, my instructor was my on-screen boss, Jason Warner Smith, who plays Gavin on The Walking Dead, is my instructor at the Robert Miller School.
Wow.
He's hardcore. I mean, he don't pull any punches, which is kind of cool. I mean, he's like, you do it. This is how you do it, and you do what I say in the room, which is cool, because that's what I need in an instructor. But he's an excellent teacher when it comes to acting. So.
Oh, that is so cool that, it's tied into the show that Gavin is your instructor there, and you were at his outpost, so, it all comes together.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I actually met him on the show before I went to the school, and he referred me to a friend that he says, I teach a class. He said, but it's a little bit more advanced, so if you're getting into this new, which I was at that time, he said, I would recommend, there's a... somebody there teaching like a viewpoints class, which talks about using your whole body, not just your head. Yeah. And not just your hands. Like I do a lot. I talk with my hands a lot. Your body reflects the light, goes with the background. It works with everything. Ileana Marianas teaches that, and she was a great teacher. So I took that, and then after I took that class, and we got done with that class, and Jason said, well, how'd you like it? I said, it was phenomenal. He goes, I wanted to find out. He said, because if you took that class and said it sucked, then you wouldn't have been right for my class. I was like, hey. So he's after that, because he always does the interview process with his classes, and so he said, if that was okay, then you're a good candidate for my class. And I was like, okay, cool. So that's what we did. So I took his class after that.
Awesome. And aside from having a dog that's under your feet somewhere right now, you also have an affinity for cats. I remember we had talked about that on Twitter a little bit.
I'm a cat person.
Absolutely. Same here.
A lot of the people that have followed me on Twitter would know me as the guy that's Cooper's dad. Cooper was my taxi. I had a taxi named Cooper. And now my daughter is 23, just moved to St. Pete. And I told her, when Cooper was 2 weeks old, she says, I want to take the kittens when I move out. I said, yeah, sure, no problem. Well, the only problem was that in the year and a half, 2 years before she moved, me and Cooper got really attached. I got attached to Cooper. Cooper's a cat. He's like, yeah, whatever. But I was really attached to Cooper a lot. Half of my Twitter and Instagram was filled up with me and Cooper. He would sit on my shoulders. If he was here, he would be sitting on my shoulder while I'm talking to you, because that's where he sat. I'd walk around the house. I'd do a lot of the cooking because I like to cook, and he has laid across my shoulders the entire time I'm cooking, just laid there while I did everything. No big deal. I called him Brocat. He would sleep in the same spot every night. He'd stand on my chest, and then he would just start purring, and he'd relax, and he would just fall over, and that's where he slept for a good couple of hours and all that. But when she moved, I told her, I said, well, she goes, now you said I could take him. I said, I know, go ahead. And I relented, and it was not easy because I still get pictures from her. She sends me pictures and updates on it, let me know how he's doing. So, but I still got these other three cats I've got. They're all brother and sister. They're 11 years old. They'll be 11 years old, next week, in fact, that they have been around, and the other cats came and went, and those three are still here. So, I'm still a cat person, and the dog. Well, she's the dog. Yeah, it belongs to you. That's
all right. And now, I think it will be a good time to shift gears and start talking about The Walking Dead. But let's talk about the comic book first. I've only briefly kind of looked at it. I know that the comic for the most part, has its own storyline. You know, the show breaks off from it. You'd be a fan of the comic as well?
I was. I didn't know there was a comic book the first season or two until the first season or two of The Walking Dead was going on. You know, because I didn't catch it right away. Because when I was airbrushing in Panama City, it was when it first came out, and it came out on Sunday nights, and I worked Sunday nights, so I never got to see it right away. So my daughter went over to spend the night at one of her friend's house, and they said, "We watched The Walking Dead." I said, "What's it like?" And she goes, "It was really cool, but it's kind of gory." I was like, "Well," and then I we sat down one time on Netflix. She binged to watch three seasons in one weekend. I mean, by the end of the weekend, she was just like worn out, but she saw all of it. I said, "Well, is it that good?" She goes, "Yeah." So I wound up doing almost the same thing over a period of a couple of weeks and caught everything up to date. And then I just couldn't wait for the next one to come on. So I was like the major Walking Dead head kind of guy, you know. When I was at work, we would sit around. Whenever somebody needed to know what was going on with The Walking Dead, I was the one that they went to, you know. And then I had read some of the comics, and I found those, and I started reading those and seeing how it tied in. And the differences between the comic book and the show were, although the timeline and storyline is generally the same, there's a lot of differences in characters. People, like, you know, Andrea was in the comic book, was Rick's girlfriend still. Of course, you know, and Andrea, she's been gone since, season three?
Yeah, I think season three is when she got killed off.
It's just so many different things, you know, and I think in the comic book, Abraham's the one that got the arrow through the eye, like Denise did, but you know, it all comes out a little bit different, and but the storyline is basically the same, you know, starts at Atlanta, works its way up, they go to Washington, that's where they're at, and then that's when they meet the Saviors. The Whisperers were another one that hadn't shown up, Scavengers. The storyline is similar, but there's a lot of differences that I can see from one to the other. Now, I am not up to date on the comic books now. I got to the part, because I remember in All Out War in the comic books, I was like, man, they are dragging this out. When are they going to get rid of this guy, this Negan guy, and these Saviors? What a pain in the ass. But, you know, so now I am one of the Saviors. So
now you're like, hey, now we could stick around for a little while.
What?
If she wants to get on camera.
Run. Yeah, the dog is trying to get back over here, but then I offer her to pick her up, she runs.
Yeah, of course, camera shy. Doesn't want to be in the podcast. All right, I get it.
And the cat's sitting over there watching me from behind the hamper.
All right, and now...
He's being very judgmental, too. He always is.
Now, let's get into The Walking Dead. We could talk about this past Sunday's episode, because we learned a lot with this last Sunday's episode. One thing that we learned...
That was a good episode.
It was. And a couple of things that we learned. One thing we learned is that Jadis actually has the ability to talk normal. It seems that she's not talking like Yoda anymore.
She talks normal. Like before that, I was like, were they like escapees from an insane asylum and they just holed up in the trash bin or what? But now that all that's gone on, then she's talking normal, living in this nice, pristine apartment, hitting none of this.
Yeah.
So, and the helicopter. What? You know.
I got a theory about the helicopter.
I've seen at least two references in this past Sunday to, I'm talking like season one and season two. You know, in season one, Rick seen that helicopter up on the building reflecting back. He went right around and found that horde of zombies.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what the first thing I thought of when the helicopter showed up again. I'm like, what's going on with this? Where's the helicopter coming from? And I never did find out about that other helicopter. And the other was, what's his name? Henry?
Oh, yeah, the little kid.
He was hiding in the exact same place that Sophia was supposed to have stayed in. In the second season. So, because Rick got her, put her in that...
Yeah.
Next to that creek and said, stay there. And she didn't stay there. You know, that was a heartbreaking part, too. But then, Henry, that's where they find him, is in this to some previous episodes that I saw. And there was probably a couple other little Easter eggs I didn't know about.
Oh, definitely.
On Easter Sunday. Anyway.
But my whole theory with the helicopter, I think because, you know, now that Georgie and her people were introduced, you know, the Martha Stewart-looking lady.
I missed that one, and then I'm like, whoa, what's going on with this? I was lost on that one. I missed a couple of them this time around, but I did catch this past Sunday, so.
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna catch back up.
Well, we could talk about this past Sundays, because there's other things in there, too.
Yeah.
Now, Rick is either becoming more and more like the governor, or he just has like a really morbid sense of April Fool's Day humor. Because with the Saviors, you know, he was talking them into, you know, look, you can come back to the hilltop, we can work this out. Because they were kind of transients. They were, you know, okay, we can't really go back to the sanctuary because, Simon wants to kill us because, you know, we got captured, so we can't really go back there. So they were thinking about it. And then they were actually working with Morgan and Rick. They fought off the Horde. And then, you know, like, Rick is basically turned around and, April Fools, none of you all going to live.
He was just talking about, a man's got nothing left in this world but his word. I said, well, he ain't got that left anymore either, apparently. If you think about, if you were another group outside and you seen Rick and you met him and figured out what he is about, you're like, yeah, this guy has death and destruction following him everywhere he goes. He would be the same way that we see Negan. And are they any different than these two?
I was also going to touch on that because, especially in this last episode, we've seen a very human side of Negan. You know, when Jadis was going to burn Lucille. And, of course, Negan opened up about Lucille. We didn't know her name at the time to Father Gabriel. He was talking to him, so he touched on that, hey, I had a wife. But then he really, you know, with Jadis, he had, like, really kind of tied emotionally to her, saying, no, you know, Lucille, she helped me through tough times, and I named the bat after her, and that bat helped me through.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she had felt sympathetic for him, and that's why ultimately, anyone that has a watch, sorry, she had let him go, willingly.
and not to mention, and it's not that he's all killer mode, because they both parted ways in one piece, Jadis and him.
Yeah.
So, somewhere they had a common ground, like, okay, you go your way, I'll go mine. And
he actually invited her along with him.
In the car. Because that we don't know yet.
No, we don't know, but I have a theory. I think, I don't know, should I mention my theory? Okay.
Theories are cool. I love theories. What I don't like is spoilers.
All right, well, this...
Knows for a fact, here's a picture, this is what happens.
No.
No. Fan theories, to me, I love that. Because we can speculate. Oh, well, why do you think that? Well, here's what I think, and
this definitely, I have no inside information. This is just speculating, totally.
Yeah.
I think the person that he picked up, because remember when Dwight was ambushed by the Alexandrians, of course, he staged that ambush, he made sure, and he killed some of his own people, but Laura, the hot blonde with the barcode on the side of her neck, she had gotten away, and we haven't seen her for a while now. I'm wondering if that is who Negan.
And I forgot all about that because the last I seen was one of the scenes that I was working in was with her, and it was whatever she ran off and then hadn't seen her. Where did she go? And nothing else has been said. That's a very good idea there. I hadn't even thought about that.
And you know, I'm thinking
Dwight, because he kind of talked Dwight a little bit,
Yeah, because I saw in the coming attractions, for the next episode, it showed Negan. You know, he sees Dwight and he's like, "Are you surprised that I'm here, Dwight?"
Yeah.
He's like, because I guess that he knows that him and Simon were kind of planning. We don't need Negan. Let's run this whole thing ourselves. So maybe he's like, okay, well, now that I'm back in the picture, you know, did you think I was going to come back? Or, you know, so I think next week's episode is going to really start to bring everything a lot more closer together, because he's got to deal with Simon.
Yep.
And we know he's going to, Simon's got it coming to him. I think he's going to be really shocked when he sees Negan. And he's going to be, he's alive? Oh my God. He's alive. Yay, I think.
So, I don't know. There's going to be a lot that's going to come out. I don't know. You know, and they are, from what they have gotten renewed for season 9 that I've heard.
Yeah.
And that's one thing. Whenever I was on there, we never knew what was going on anywhere else. We only knew the parts that we were filming. So if somebody said, hey, you can tell me what really happened, I said, I have no idea, because they don't tell us, you know.
And they do that on purpose. They want to keep everything locked up.
First
so
I did was 702, and as when Gavin first showed up, and all we knew was that one scene. We didn't know what was going on anywhere else. We didn't know who was filming what somewhere else. What was going on in Sonoya, we have no idea. We knew what we were in, and that was it. Yeah. Which was fine by me. I didn't mind it, because that still, even being in the show, you still had surprises when you watched it, you know.
Oh, definitely.
That was pretty cool, yeah.
And also, getting on topic, staying on topic with the show, is there any behind the scenes stuff, like shenanigans that goes on that you could talk about? Because I want to take a guess first at who I think probably has the biggest sense of humor. I'm gonna say Norman Reedus and maybe Jeffrey Dean Morgan. I think that I could see those two guys clowning a lot.
I would say that Norman does, but that's the only thing, is that I was only in one scene with him, and I didn't get to hear a lot about, you know, what was going on, because we were just so disconnected that night. Because mostly now, Kari Payton plays Ezekiel. He is in real life as probably as funny and as jovial as what Jerry the character is like on The Walking Dead. You watch it, you see Jerry come up, you know, that first time, and he's like, you know, he's like, deuces, you know, that.
Oh yeah.
How Kari Payton is in real life. He's always talking about something. He's got everybody laughing. It's kind of fun to be around, you know. You know, we were one of the scenes that we did in it was 710, where we were just doing a pickup from them, and we were loading this stuff in the Jeep, and it was hot that day, and we're loading these watermelons in, and then we loaded these batteries, and Carl's like, man, why don't we just here? I got a sword. We can just take these watermelons. We can cut them up. We'll just have a picnic. You know, I'm like, you know, everybody's just like just normal people when you get out there. Although some of the ones are like that you've known for years, and that you're kind of like, you tend to idolize certain people. Lenny James is a phenomenal actor.
Yes.
Do his craft right there in front of us and see him be able to say, okay, so then, and they'll yell, cut. Okay, Lenny, can you pick that up? He goes, yeah. And he would do it exact. You know, there was almost, I've been on set probably 4 or 5 times, and they almost never had to stop and cut because somebody made a mistake. They're just that good. Lenny James, they didn't miss lines, you know. They were just good at what they did, and it's just, you're like, wow, will I ever even get to that kind of level? One of the coolest things, you know, for me, because Lenny James, and I watched him, first time I seen him was on Lost in Space, and then seen him in Sahara.
Jericho. Did you see? Did you ever see that show Jericho with him?
Yes, I did see that.
Great show. That's where I first ran into him.
Seeing this guy that I have known and have watched for years, and I'm with at the craft table, and here comes Lenny James walking up. He's getting a cup of coffee or whatever. He looks over. He goes, and me and one of the other saviors are standing up there. He just looked over and he shook their hand. He goes, hey, you guys are doing a good job. Appreciate you guys. I say, hey, we're just here to make you look good, man. He goes, well, appreciate it. So he walks off, and we just watch him walk off. And when he gets out of eyesight, we're like, oh, my God, I just sipped Lenny James' hand. You know? We're like, okay. But you have that little brief moment where you just could.
Yeah. Oh, when you meet great actors like that, absolutely.
You can't act like a fanboy, you know.
Definitely. And, you know, another thing that we could talk about with Lenny James, and this is really interesting, and when Fear the Walking Dead first came out, I had thought that they would eventually tie the shows together, that they'd bring them together.
We had theories about that, too.
I was like, okay, at some point, they got to kind of bring everything together, and they're actually going to be doing that because Lenny James is going to Fear the Walking Dead. And, you know, because we know that the character he plays, Morgan, is, you know, he's starting to see ghosts and he's losing his mind again. He's going crazy. And we know what happened the last time he did that. It was, you know, the episode Clear, where he was
probably one of my all-time favorite episodes.
Yes. That one, that episode, and Here's Not Here is one of my favorite. You know, Lenny James,
which one?
Here's Not Here. Remember where he meets the cheesemaker?
My two favorite ones is mostly because they tie in was Clear and 7/13 Bury Me Here, because you started seeing him start to lose that little grip on reality again and flashing back to Clear. Those two are probably my absolute favorite ones.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, definitely.
And that was also the episode that I was on that one, but what I like about it was that when we were out there filming, that was whenever he killed Richard. And we were watching him do this performance, and we're sitting there, when he got done, and we looked back and said, man, he needs an award for this performance, just for what we've seen. This is awesome. We're like, guys, they were like, oh, yeah, we're on set. I forgot, you know. But he would go back through it, and what he would say, we're like, wow, you know, just watching this guy work is pretty awesome. But whenever he was just, he's just that good. And I say he's still probably my idol as far as an actor goes. I just thought that was kind of cool. And I don't know how I contained myself one day. I was sitting, driving through Atlanta. I was going back, going to one of my classes. And I left work early, and I stopped. I was going through town, and I was like, man, I need to stop, take a break. Well, this is part of Atlanta called Little Five Points. Kind of unique little area. I pulled in there, and I went to Starbucks, sitting back down, got me something. And this car pulls up. Lenny James gets out, walks in, wearing just, you know, just no hat, t-shirt, walks up, and he looks over, and I just kind of nodded. He didn't know who it was, you know. I was just, you know, one of those guys, but got his coffee, and he walks back out. I'm like, holy crap, Lenny James is one, and nobody even recognized him. What was that mean? I was trying all I could not to go like, Lenny!
Yeah.
But it was pretty cool just to sit back and just see him walk in as a normal guy, get something, leave. Nobody even knew who he was, so.
Wow, yeah, that.
A little bit of anonymity, because I'm sure he gets, you know, plenty of his own followers as it is, but to be able to just stop and get out and walk in, or walk back out and no one say anything, it's probably kind of a nice break for him, so.
And in regard to this Sunday's episode, because this is something that I wanted to mention too, Jared, who's, of course, the savior that I think everyone's, like, most hated savior. He wound up dying brutally at the hands of Morgan. And, you know, and I remember before, like, when Rick and Morgan were tied up, you know, Jared goes up to him and says, hey, this guy strangled one of his own people to death. He choked him to death. I saw it. These guys are crazy. And then, of course, when they're wrestling on the ground, he's got the spear and he's taunting him with it. And Morgan just throws him off and he winds up falling behind a different part of that dive bar, and then he slides that gate over.
Yeah.
And then Jared, we see him just die a brutal death, being eaten to death by zombies.
What was cool is that whenever we were, one of my girls. whenever we have like the big part, we would have our viewing parties. There's this place in close, not far from here in Sandy Springs, Georgia, which is about 10 miles away from me. There's this place called the Ship and Anchor Pub. It's an English style pub, but you know, everybody's from Georgia there. But we have viewing parties there. We started them whenever the episodes that we showed up in, Jason said, hey, let's have, so we're going to have a viewing party that on the episode that we got coming up. You want to come on out? I'm like, yeah, sure. So we got out there. The first time we went out there for it, Jason kind of put it together. So, and Josh Michael, that plays Jared, always shows up. And Josh is a really cool guy.
He is. And you know what?
He is an awesome guy. He's just really good at playing a jerk.
Oh, he is. Because I heard on the...
If you ever see his demo reel, you'll see that's pretty much all he gets. But hey, you know, they like him like that. So that's
yeah, because on The Talking Dead...
And Jason, Josh, Cooper Andrews, Logan Miller. That's about... All of what we called at that time was Team Gavin. We had our own group. We were five of us that... In season 7, we were always there at the pickups. The first one that we went to, there's two guys that couldn't make it back, so they replaced them. But we've been our team since then. But we all made it out there for that. Several other saviors showed up. Some of our Twitter followers showed up. And we just gathered up there, and to be in a pub like that. And to watch The Walking Dead, what was really cool is that it's one of the few places where when the show comes on, everybody goes shh, and everybody gets quiet, watches the whole bar, everybody at the bar, everybody sitting down, and then when the commercial comes on, everybody gets up, runs around, they're talking, they're taking photos, they're getting signatures, they're getting autographs over here, group photos, then it comes back on, everybody runs back to the show, watch it again. So, Josh. We were sitting there, and I looked at Jason. I said, "Where's Josh? I thought he was going to be here tonight." He said, "He's not here. He said he couldn't make it." And I was like, "Man, that sucks. I thought he was going to be here." And then when he got chomped on by walkers, I was like, "Oh man, he said was he must be with his own group." And Jason's like, "I think he's occupied West Coast." I was like, "Oh, you
can't. Yeah, Talking Dead."
Talking Dead. And sure enough, he was. So
yeah, and I also wanted to say about Joshua that in real life, like you said, and this is what Chris Hardwick said on The Talking Dead, that in real life he is a really nice guy, he's a great guy, but he is just such a great actor, and they cast him in those roles. I mean, and even he was saying that, hey, if people hate me this much, it's better than not being noticed at all, because they are noticing him, and he is a phenomenal actor, and a great guy. Just wanted to throw that out there for him.
But he is, overall, Jason and him both are regular guys that are fun to be around. They're fun to talk to. They're hilarious. They're very personable. When we go out to the ship and anchor, whenever they're out there, anybody can walk up and say, "Hey guys," they're like, "Hey, let's get a picture." And that's just the way they are. They're just like that all the time. But they love their fans because they know that's what got them where they are, and they appreciate that. And that's what makes them that much more of a person. Just because they don't have this thing like, I'm a big star or nothing. And I didn't really meet anybody on the show, big stars or not, that felt that seemed like that. They were just, they're just regular people. We filmed, I guess it was 7:10 or 7:13, one or the other, but as some of the extras cast, they usually didn't put us with the big stars. But they all fed us in this one dining area, and I tell you, The Walking Dead always fed us really well. But we went down there, and everybody was in there, the cast, the crew, the guys that's dragging cables around, we're all sitting in the same room. And but knowing that I wasn't up there with the big cast. I was gonna sit down with my other savior crew. So I was walking in there. And Jason's like, "Blake." I was like, "What?" He said, "Hey, come on over here and have a seat." I was like, "Hey, the man says sit down with him. Sit down with him." So I sat down with him. And so I wound up eating lunch, sitting next to Jason, who was sitting next to Kari Payton, who was sitting across the table from Jeffrey Dean Morgan and Norman Reedus. And I'm sitting here thinking about, I'm sitting here eating lunch with these guys like I'm just a regular guy. And it's just, it's pretty cool just to say it. Hey, just to say I've been here. This is like once in a lifetime deal. If nothing else ever happened, I can always look back and see that. And one of the best things that happened was that, when we filmed that, the first episode, they told us, "You cannot tell anybody because this is top secret." Okay, no problem. We filmed that in May 702. And my youngest daughter was a big big fan of The Walking Dead until Glenn died off, and she kind of lost interest. so she didn't even know that I had filmed it, and they said, "Well, what'd you film?" I said, and I had gone down to film, and I was an extra on the Liam Neeson movie with Martin Felt. And she said, "Well, what are you dressed up? You look dirty today." I said, "I was on a biker gang." I was wearing the little ragged vest and all that. And she was so mad whenever Glenn got killed off at the beginning of the... Oh, she was upset. She was mad. She said she was sad. So we were watching 702. We just got... Because Walker Stalker Atlanta, we just come back from that because we went down there, but... They have a viewing downtown, but I said, let's just go home. There's a football game going on. There's a lot going on. So let's just go home and do this. So we got home, and we're all sitting around, and my oldest daughter, she goes, "You going to tell them?" Because she knew that I was in. It was kind of hard. She knew. Don't look at me on that. Anyway, she... you didn't know. Well, she was over there, and we told her, "Come here, look at..." She goes, "No, I'm too sad. I don't like... Glenn's gone. I don't want to come see it." "No, you've got to come see who's coming on the show." Like, "I don't know if I..." So she finally walked in there, and it was right at the scene where I walked up with Jason getting out of that red SUV. And she goes, and one of my daughters goes, "Who's that guy?" She goes, "I don't know. What? Is that you? You didn't tell me?" And she hit me. So I'm sitting here. I'm supposed to be this big, tough savior, and here's my little 15-year-old hitting me with her kids like this, and I'm trying to block her. I'm like, I couldn't tell you. Okay, 16. Oh, you were 15 at that time, my dear. Thank you very much. No, you weren't. But, yeah, I got attacked because I did not tell her. And the first time she knew that, I was on The Walking Dead, and she seen me on screen. And so she got her video camera out, and she's like, and she held it up to the TV, and she held it up at me, and she held it back to the TV, and she goes, "What? What?" So,
wow, that is like the...
That was a tough secret to keep, but it was...
I was going
to
say, that's like the...
to show her like...
That's like the biggest secret in the world to keep right there.
So, whenever they said, "Don't tell anybody," I didn't even tell my own daughter, who was like a huge mega fan. So...
Oh, but of course she found out.
I can retain a secret or two once in a while.
But, yeah... A secret like that, though, eventually she's going to find out. If she's a big mega fan, be like, "Wait a minute, is that Dad? Is that you?"
Because she wasn't going to watch it. So,
ah.
She was still mad because the week before she saw Glenn die and Abraham. And then the next week I show up on there and I'm trying to get her to stay and watch it so you can see me. I said, "Would you just sit down and look?" You know? So,
it's like I can't... It's like, I can't tell you anything, but, you know, just watch.
Yeah, that was how it went.
So. All right.
But, yeah, it was, we went back, and the only time I show up this time around was in the season, mid-season finale, and at the beginning of the mid-season premiere. I was outside the gate when the trash truck blasted through. You can barely see Glenn, so he dived into a car going after him. There's another time when, which was funny, was that at the exact same time on the timetable, Negan's on the other side of Alexandria yelling at Carl. Well, I was also in that group, but they put me way out back. This is the next day. So that way they wouldn't notice that I was in the same scene on both sides.
Oh, yeah, so makes sense.
I was just there as an extra, but way in the background, so... Couldn't really see me on that one.
And
on the beginning of the mid season, whenever in the first episode, right at the very beginning, you see Morgan with a gun looking through the sights at the saviors up in the window, trying to figure out what they're doing. And what they were doing was shooting the walkers, creating a walker wall so they could escape. And that's how they escaped. I don't know if they were ever really clear about how.
No.
As they said, how did they get out of the sanctuary?
And yeah, because all you see is all the dead walkers.
But I was one of the guys up in the window shooting, which was weird because that they added... We rarely ever use any kind of ammo or blanks. It's almost all done CGI, which I don't want to ruin. I know that ruins it for some people. But the only thing was that what I was using was a... It was a semi-automatic shotgun. But when I watched the actual filming, it's got flashes like a machine gun. And I'm like... Okay, that went quite right. But First thing, knows it was actually a machine gun, but it was actually a shotgun I was holding. After that, then we went downstairs, and then you see the scene where he also sees them when they bust open and they come out shooting. I was the last person to come out, and they cut it just before I came out, because that's when somebody started shooting at him. So I was like, oh, I was so close to being back on screen. they cut that scene. They cut it right when they, like, the girl, and then this guy come out, start shooting, then two more people, then two more people, and then I was at the very tail end bringing up the rear, you know, come out blazed on both sides, and they cut it just before I stepped out. So I missed all that. But it was fun being there.
Oh, definitely. And, like, how long does it take to shoot a season of The Walking Dead?
Oh, God, some of the scenes are nightmarish. 7/13 was the one where Benjamin got shot, and then Richard got killed. So it was two small scenes. It started, and they ended with one, and then they started with another. But it was on the next day. That we filmed that in one day, and we started that morning when the sun was coming up, and we ended after the sun went down using lights to finish up the scene. It was a good 14 hours for 5 minutes of airtime.
Wow.
And it's like I said, they don't break because somebody messed their lines up, because I don't think I actually seen anybody actually mess their lines up. They all know them so well that they're that good that they can just, they know it. But when you see the scene where you have the two people, like, the guy's like this going, okay, and then you see the other scene from, it looks like a conversation. But what it is that they film this scene all from one direction. They break the cameras down, everybody stays in position, they turn the cameras around, they film the entire scene again from this direction, and then they piece those two together. Doing that for from different angles, from above, the side, from this side, and this side. Whenever you're doing several scenes like that, it's all day. And if it's 95 degrees like it was back in October, 95 degrees, it's a long day. And they're constantly bringing us water, making sure we're cooled down. First time Jason actually talked to me, that first episode that I was in with him, I'm standing there wearing my camo green pants and a black sleeveless button-up shirt with a shotgun thrown over one shoulder and an umbrella over the other. So, but it was black, so at least it matched my gun. But it was just that because it was a sun. I mean, we were crawling under the truck. They probably gave us an umbrella to block the sun from us. Just the umbrella and the shotgun was just a weird combination. And it just...
Nice.
What else we got? What other questions about that? I'd answer anything I can.
About, like, how long does it take to shoot a whole season of The Walking Dead? Like, the summer, pretty much?
The season, they split it up, like, just like they do the mid-season. They'll film, the first half of the episodes will start in about late April, early May. And then they usually film to about July. The end of July, take a few weeks break, and then they come back and start filming the second season from there until about November, which gave us a lot of opportunity to get out there. And there was a chance to come back out there, but, you know, I wouldn't say my schedule, like, I got all these offers and stuff, but my regular daytime job actually takes up most of my time. So I had to take that into account because I still got to pay bills.
Oh, yeah.
So that kind of kept me from being able to get back out there anymore. But I tell you, if I'd have been out there for more, I would have been out there in a heartbeat if I could, just because of it's The Walking Dead. I mean, of course.
Great. So does your job, like, give you much time off where you can kind of go on auditions or, like, castings or bookings?
Most of the auditions that I go to, I either do like this, where I have everything set up behind me, and I can do it on the camera, which a lot more and more are starting to accept that, which is kind of cool. I just auditioned for one that I sent out, Texas, in fact, somewhere out there. But it's kind of cool because you can set up, you can audition, you can do it, film it, upload it, and you just apply it without having to drive to Texas and audition there cool. Now, there's some that I've gone to downtown, which, you know, here being here just outside of the main part of Atlanta, it's from my house to downtown is 20 to 30 minutes, depending on the day. Which this last one I went to, I did an audition for a semi-bad guy that's Russian. So, which is getting away from The Walking Dead, but it's something that, you know, I do like to share this. In fact, if you were to call my phone and you get a voicemail right now, you're going to hear me speaking with this really bad Russian accent. And that's because when I went in there, I went in as the part I was applying for was this guy that was a former Russian mercenary now living in Atlanta trying to blend in, but something pulls him back into that world of being hitman slash mercenary. And I went and tried for them. So I went in to be the part. I went in as the guy. I went in, walk in there. My name's Blaine Rekond. I'm here for the part of whatever his name was, and talked with this bad accent. And they're like, oh, okay, sure. And we did the, my idea is not so much I'm trying to pull something over somebody. I'm just trying to be that guy. So I'm Russian. My father was Spanish. My mother was Russian. And you call my phone, you'll hear a message with a fake accent that sounds really bad, but that's because I lived in the South so long, it misses a good accent, you know. So, that's just the way you go for that. Now, may not ever hear nothing back from them. Maybe they catch this podcast and they'll say, hey, that guy's not Russian after all. But the best part about going down there, and this is something I was wanting to share with you, was this is in a part of town which is probably not the best part of town, right next to the main Greyhound bus station in the Southeast. A lot of people down there living on the streets, doing what can to make a buck. You go and somebody's wanting to help you park, and I'm watching your car for you, and they're looking for some change, my handout, whatever you got. And I went for that part that day dressed like that, and I went in to be that guy. I had on a black shirt, had a black dress jacket, black pants, black shoes, was a bad Russian accent, so if nothing else, I looked intimidating. So I went in, one guy was another time talking, and I said, okay, no, thank you very much. And I walked on inside, and I went to do the audition, got there, did the audition, thanked them for having me there, and I walked back out. And I used to smoke a couple of years. I've quit now. But I also knew that when I walked out, there's a group of about six or seven of these guys living on the street were hanging out real close to my car. Then I knew I was going to be a target to say, hey, man, he helped us out, we're on a tough time. I was like, I know it's going to happen. And I understand people out on the street and stuff. But I went ahead and did the part. As soon as I walked up, I seen two or three of them turn around and look and said, okay, we got a target here. So before one of them started to say something, and before he did, I pulled out this dollar, just a dollar I had on me, in fact. I said, I need a cigarette. Who's got a cigarette? I have a dollar for a cigarette. And somebody's like, they're kind of shocked, like, What you need, man? All I got is cool. I said, it does not matter. Just give me one. I have a bad day. And so, when I'm looking around, he got a cigarette out and handed it to me, and I handed him a dollar. And I said, I need a light. Who's got a light? And the guy's like, hey, man, give the man a light. And I said, I need a light now. I said, give him a light. Hurry up. So he goes, where are you from? I said, I'm from Russia. Had a bad day. I just went for a job, but things stopped working out. I must go. So I left. And they just stared at me. I just kind of glanced at them. They were just kind of looking at me like, but look, where's he? Yeah, they just didn't know what to say. They were all speechless. And I just walked over to my car and got in and left. But I had more fun doing that than I actually did in the audition because
they bought it.
Now, the guys in the audition might not have been convinced, but these guys were convinced. The Russian guy, upset, dressed in black, wanting a cigarette, and had to go. Got to go now. I had a lot of fun with that. That was the most I've had acting in a while. So.
that is a great story.
But aside from that, I've also done two short films that hopefully are making its way around to the film circuit right now. Some of the festivals. And one of them is called Weeping Inventory. Deals a lot with the how society views younger black men, in which I'm there. I'm playing a bad guy. I'm a very uncaring bailiff. Has a great story behind it about what, how it reflects back to the older days of how people were treated versus how they are now, and the similarities between the two and how they interact. And kind of a flashback to a time period previously where I was another bad guy, but it's the same guy, and I said, oh, it's just weird. But it's good. It's a very short film, but it's a very good one. Very well made. I'm working on another one. We got one more scene to do for it because we had to wait for good weather, and one of the girls that's helping make the film is actually still in school, and it's part of her film project. But there's a small network called STGN close by. It's a satellite network, and we're doing a film called Happy Hour, where I play a once high-powered executive that now has a drinking problem and is beating up this teenage kid because he thinks he's worthless, and I'm playing another bad guy. And play it very well, I think. We were asking, the producer was talking to us, and she says, how do you guys interact? What do you think of this? And the guy that plays my teenage son and his friend, oh, we get along great. I said, no, how do you and your dad get along? He said, oh, I hate his guts. I'm like, yes. I'm convincing it. But in real life, he's an okay guy, so I'm glad you threw that in there. So, but that's another. We got one more thing to do with that because we had to wait for really good weather for it, and we'll be finished with that. And hopefully, we'll have something else rolling in soon afterwards. So, that's two of the projects I've worked on recently. So, hopefully, we got other stuff coming up in works. Be nice to see anyway.
All right. Well, you know, that would have been my next question: is what, you know, any kind of upcoming acting plans that you got, and you pretty much covered that. And
yeah, we also, you know, like I say, I want to get back into some classes and get see what else I can learn. But the other thing is that it's just more of a getting out there and trying it, finding some auditions. I mean, I don't have an agent yet, which would make things a little bit easier with finding stuff and going to auditions. I mean, I think Jason said one time he spent a year where he just, you know, he booked very little, but he went through so many auditions, but those are the auditions that you get out of the way. Now you can move on to the ones that are productive, and you learn stuff from every audition you go to. And I was like, well, I'd like to be in a position where I can go to several of them. Most of them right now are on weekends or on video, which is good. The first video audition was awful. Yeah, weirdly enough and very oddly enough, somebody like me who grew up very shy has an easier time in a live audition in front of people than I do a video audition like this, like when I'm talking on to a video. Doing a video audition, I have a harder time doing that than I do actually walking into a real audition with people behind the table listening to me talk. Now, why it's like that, I don't know. I guess because I can go back and play it. Oh, this is awful. But I don't know why it's so different.
Yeah. I mean, like, when I'm doing podcast interviews, it just seems that everything flows great. But when I do my intro, it like takes me probably over an hour to do like a little 3 or 4 minute intro. I'm like, what is with the intro? Why does that look like such a mental block? But I can relate to what you're saying about the video auditions as opposed to, you know, doing it live and in person.
Yeah, and even then, and I guess, you know, also live in person, you just roll with it. If you mess up, you just keep going. But on video, I know I have the opportunity to stop and change it. Except when I'm doing the video and I'm talking on it, you're like, okay, well, the reason, you know, that deputy knew who he was. I mean, damn it.
Oh, I know.
It takes like that. And then you finally get where you can almost get it right. And then here's a cat wanting to come to the door. There's a dog wanting to go out again. Here's a cat wanting to come back. The dog wants you to go feed her or take her out, and you're like, okay, I'm done. We're gonna call it a night, you know, and just start again the next day. The other day, the one I finished up, I practiced it. We did 21 takes on it, trying to get it right, and I just gave up. The other night, we did three. The third one turned out just right, and I was like, that's good. We're done. So sometimes they're fun, sometimes they're frustrating.
Oh, definitely. And well, Blaine, I want to say in closing, hey, it's been, thank you so much once again for being on my show. I'm a rookie podcaster. I'm You know, I'm just getting started with this. Like I said, you're episode 3. So I'm something new I'm getting into. Because I am looking to get back into acting again myself. I just did, like years ago, some extra work.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of looking, you know, I only stuck around for a couple of years, but this time out, I'm kind of looking to stick in for the long haul. I want to do more than like 2 years, you know?
Yeah, so, and like I said, it was years ago, I want to do that, but I grew up a very introverted person, and over the years, I became more and more past that. Now, every time I step up in front of a camera or I've done something like that, all that makes me want to do is do it again. And it's exciting to do that. And when I've stepped up in front of the camera and got it right, that feeling is just phenomenal. You know, we did that. I shot one part with that last film I'm working on, that little short film, where I'm accusing my son on screen as being a liar, stealing my beer, which he's not. I'm just a drunk. That's just a jackass is what it is. But I'm shoving him back, and I'm yelling at him, and when I scream at him to sit down, and it landed just right, and it worked out, and they said cut. I was like, man, I hope you really hate me, because that was a really good shot. But he played along very well with it, too. So, you know, but when I got done, and you get to see that, and you're like, oh man, we nailed that one. That's a pretty good feeling, though, you know, to be able to do that. Whereas years ago, I couldn't even look at the camera and said my name, much less do a, you know, an acting. It's just, everybody changes a little bit over the years, and I've changed in a completely different way than what I was then. Now it's perfectly fine to get in front of the camera and talk, even listening to myself talk, which most people hate doing. I kind of got through that barrier. And I can listen to a video of it now and figure out what I did wrong, what can I fix, how can I change it for next time, you know, and listen to myself without thinking, oh, I sound awful, to just going, oh, I need to quit doing that, my head's turning that way, I'm not making a smacking sound, you know. So it's all, everybody changes a little bit on that, and that seems to have worked out better for me, and I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad I didn't start way too early. I like being where I'm at right now, because I think there's a lot of opportunity for something my age, which is one of the things about acting, is that you don't have a lot of, they do look for a lot of younger people, but you can find a lot of roles for your age group.
So, oh, yeah. That is definitely true. Yeah. Always opportunities.
Yeah.
And, well, Blaine, once again, hey, I want to thank you so much for being on my show. It was a blast. I mean, I love this conversation. It was great. I get to know you more as a person, and it's just a great story to tell. I had a blast.
Like a lot of things, is once I get started and talking, I have a hard time shutting up, which I get told that a lot now. I used to not have that problem. I used to be the shy kid. Now I'm the guy that won't shut up and have to be told to quiet down. So, which for me, that's good. I like that. So it's not too bad. So,
all right.
Okay, you're on. Okay.
All right. He made his guest appearance. I did.
Yeah, that was Coco.
Coco made his guest appearance on my podcast.
She's good. She went back. She's back.
Well.
Okay.
All right. Hey, you know, if you wanted to tell anyone else in The Walking Dead about your podcast, especially Gavin, I'd love to have him on the show. It would be great.
I do know a couple of saviors that. J.D. Hunt, you would recognize him. He's 6'5" and bald-headed. Looks really mean.
Okay.
One of our saviors from season 7. And you'll see him a little bit in season 8, too. He would be a good one, Tom. He's a 24-year law enforcement veteran.
Oh, wow.
And a savior. And an Army veteran.
So, there we go.
He would probably like it. Another one of the guys I work with, his name's Todd Stubelt. He has been in probably more films than I can count. And our other two guys that was always with us was Brian Porter and Mike Conaday. And Mike has been in many films, and he's like 6'8". I was a short guy, you know, I'm 6 foot, and I'm still, me and Brian were sitting there looking around, I was like, man, we look kind of average here. We actually look kind of short compared to these guys. Yeah. So, but all of them have a lot of experience under their belt one way or another, whether it's in film or in actual being tough guy or just, you know, all around. You know, Todd has been on, I don't know how many films he's been on, and Mike's the same way. Me and JD were probably one of the ones that are newer to the game, and even that, he's been on a few. I think he was on I seen something he was on not too long ago, I can't remember what it was, where he was a tough guy, and he really looked like a tough guy, too. But he drove over from Alabama just to be on the show, just so he could be a savior. another fan-turned-savior.
All right.
But I know those guys are probably glad to get hear from you. And, you know, Jason, I don't know, his schedule is starting to get more and more. He's going to be a featured guest at Walker Stalker's Chicago this coming weekend. So he's stepping up into the higher ranks there. And Josh, and you see Josh. He's,
oh, yeah.
But I'll see him once in a while, and I'll drop a bug on him once in a while. Let him know. Yeah, as you get a little bit more love, I'll be glad to come back sometime too.
Oh, definitely.
I have some projects under my belt we can talk about.
Yes, absolutely. I'd love to have you back on again. And in closing, tell all my listeners on social media links where they can find you.
Oh yeah, I am on Twitter and Instagram. On Instagram, you can find me as Savior678. That's not how many saviors I am, that's my area code. That's the only thing I can think of. Somebody says, you're number 678. I said, no, that's my area code, Savior678. Yeah. And I'm on Ed Blaine Rincon on Twitter. You can find me on there. Glad to see anybody come on there that would like, follow you, tag me in some photos. It's all good. I like hanging out, talking with anybody. So it's all good with that. So.
All right. Great. And well, Blaine, in closing, I would just like to say that it looks like it's been another successful delivery.
Yeah.
Thank you again for being on the show.
And not one cantaloupe short either.